Why am I choosing to write about this multi-front assault on our society, culture, families, and very way of life? Because I see it. I know where it is headed, and I refuse to choose to accept it. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. How to push back against the social media platforms. How to get your family strong again. You can get it anywhere books are sold on February 27th. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. Principle number one, be who you are on purpose. So what is it I want you to get out of this? I want you to get out of this fill in the blank series an edge. I want you to get an edge in your life. And here's the first edge I want you to get. I want you to be able to figure out who you are and how you got to be who you are, where you are. Now, think about that. You know what you do. You know what your job is. You're a mom, you're a dad, but you're a baker, a candlestick maker, you're an accountant or an architect or a teacher. That's what you do. That's not who you are. So I want you to know who you are, and more importantly, how you got to be there. And I'm going to tell you how we're going to figure this out. All right, now to help you figure out that distinction, I've got to give you some tools to do that, okay? The first thing I'm going to ask you to do is move your position. To understand what I mean by that, I want you to fill this sentence in for me. How would you complete this sentence? I would rather be right than blank. Think about that. I'd rather be right than blank. Now, I guarantee you, 90% plus of you finish that sentence this way. You said, I'd rather be right than wrong. Of course, you'd rather be right than wrong. Nobody wants to be wrong. If you're in an argument or you're picking out something, you always want to be right. So you'd finish that sentence, I'd rather be right than wrong. I want you to move your position just for the time that you're listening to me today. And for the rest of this Living by Design series, what I want you to do is think about it differently. I want you to finish the sentence this way. I don't want you to say, I'd rather be right than wrong. What I want you to say is, I would rather be happy than right. Now, that's very different. I would rather be happy than right. Look, we have enough right fighters. We got enough people out there that are right. They're always right, always got to be right. God, don't you get sick of those people that are right all the time. I don't want you to be one of those. I don't want you to be right. I want you to be happy. I mean, you might get in an argument with your kid and say, get a haircut, no tattoos, shut up, do what I tell you. You may be right because you're the parent, but does it make you happy? Does it make your family happy? So I'm going to ask you to move your position just for the time we're talking. Instead of being so committed to being right in terms of evaluating everything I talk to you about in terms of whether what I'm telling you is right or wrong, what I want to ask you to do is look at it in terms of whether what I'm telling you makes you happy. Now, when I say move your position, what do I mean by that? Think about it. I can say, okay, stand at the hood of your car. Now move to the trunk of your car. That's moving your position. That's what I want you to do in your attitude, your mind. I actually want you to move your position. Now, what do you have to do to affect this change from being right to being happy? Well, let's call roll because I want everybody here that needs to be there in order for this to happen. And I got some good news and some bad news. It's a short list. Because the good news is the only person you need to make this change is you. The bad news is the only person you need to make this change is you. Now, why is that bad news? Because you can't blame anybody. You're not a victim. You can't say, well, my wife's got to change. My husband's got. No, they don't. No, they don't. They can do whatever they want to do. You have to be the one that changes your attitude. Maybe they'll change. Maybe they won't. But when I call roll on who needs to be involved for you to stop being right and start being happy, you're the only one that's involved. You're the only one that you control. And doesn't that work out well? You're the only one you need to control to change from being right to being happy. So let's just get this right. If you're going to live by design, the design is for you. Everybody else you can inspire. I mean, you can get them all excited. Maybe they want to follow you, maybe they don't. But the only person you control is you. So let's clean your house first. We'll worry about everybody else later. By the way, that's always been the case. You have always been the only person you've ever controlled, and you have been doing it on purpose. You may not have thought you were, but you have always done this on purpose. Now, you're probably wondering, why is a 12-year-old sitting around wondering why people do what they do and don't do what they don't do? I remember the split second I became obsessed with that. We had a football game rain out when I was like 12 years old. And we usually play on Saturdays. It was a big rainstorm, so we got rained out. And on Monday, the phone rings, and the Salvation Army calls. And they say to our coach, look, we've got a team over here, and we don't get to play all that much. And we saw that you guys had your game rain out on Saturday. Could we come over and play a scrimmage game with you on Monday? And the coach says, well, sure, of course we will. Now, look, I got to tell you, we're pretty cocky. We think we're good, and we look good. I mean, we got the best uniform. They're black with these silver stripes down the side and black helmets and black wristbands. We think we're really bad, okay? So these guys pull up from the Salvation Army in like three pickup trucks, and it looked like the grapes of wrath out there. Now, you may be too young to remember that, but that was back in the Dust Bowl. These kids start falling out of the back of these pickups. Nothing matches. They don't have jerseys. None of the helmets match. And the kid that lines up across from me, he's got on a button-up shirt for a jersey. And the number on the shirt is 4, and it's on in masking tape. Now, I'll tell you how snotty we were. We're in the huddle back there saying, look at this kid. I mean, that's going to come off. Why didn't he do it in magic marker? Well, he didn't do it in magic marker because that was his shirt. That wasn't one of his shirts. That was his shirt. He had to wear that to school the next day. That's why he put the number on in masking tape. Football pants? He had no football pants. He rolled his blue jeans up to his knees so they look like football pants. Football shoes? No football shoes. He had on loafers. So we've got all this fancy uniforms and equipment. We're thinking we're so bad. And here's this ragtag team, number 4 lined up across from me. And I got to tell you, when they snapped that ball, that kid hit me so hard, it still hurts when it rains. He hit my shoulder. I thought I'd been hit by a truck. And I got to tell you, over the next hour, they beat us like they were clapping for a barn dance. It was like a track meet. We probably got beat 50-0. These kids ran over us like we were nothing. It finished up, and I crawl over to the car to get in. I looked at my dad and said, what the hell happened? And he said, well, boy, you just got your ass handed to you on a platter. That's what happened. I said, well, yeah, Dad, thanks a lot. I was hoping for a little more in-depth analysis than that. And he said, son, those boys are hungry. Those boys just wanted it more than you did. That's what happened. And right there, that moment, I became envious of those kids from the Salvation Army. In that moment, I thought, I want what they have. That seems so funny because here I was. We had all the equipment. We had grass on the field. These kids had nothing. But they were so hungry. I mean, they had that eye of the tiger inside. And I remember sitting there in the car, hurting, every part of me hurting, thinking, you know what? If they can do so much with so little, how much should I be able to do with so much? And I thought, I want what they have. Those kids were hungry. They had this desire, this I want it. And when they got a chance to play, when they got a chance to be on grass, they wanted to seize that moment, and they ate our sack lunch, I got to tell you. And it wasn't just that day, because I made friends with some of those kids, and they weren't sitting around feeling sorry for themselves. They went the extra mile every time they got a chance. Trust me, if you do something in pattern, if you do something that's part of your personality, you do it because it's what you want, because you get a payoff from it. And these kids got a payoff from being hungry. They got a payoff from being committed. You get a payoff from it some way. And if you don't get something out of it, trust me, you don't continue to do it, your life won't be made up of things that don't pay you off in some way. Now, you may think, no way, Dr. Phil, I'm not getting a payoff for this. I'm miserable. Look, I'm not saying it's a healthy payoff, but I'm saying you're getting a payoff. It may be a sick payoff. You may be sitting on the sideline watching life go by, and your payoff is you don't have to face the pressure of getting in the game. You don't have to face the risk of getting out of your comfort zone. That is a payoff. Is it healthy? No, but it is a payoff. It's a pathological payoff, but it's a payoff. You don't do something that you don't get something out of. You do what you do in your life because in some way you're getting a payoff out of it. What I want you to do is start living by design. I want you to have a definition of what success is in your life. So one of the things I'm going to be asking you to do as we move through living by design is figuring out what your payoffs are. Look for things you do in pattern and then say, what am I getting out of this? Healthy, sick, otherwise, what's my payoff? Because when you identify the payoff, then you can control the currency. And when you control the currency, then you control you. Once you know what your payoff is, you can turn that spigot on and you can turn that spigot off, and that will change what you're doing. It will change how you're living. Whatever you do, whoever you are, do that on purpose. Don't just be who you are. Live whatever life you live by accident. I mean, come on, own it. You get to the end of your life and somebody says, what did you do with your life? At least say, whatever I did it on purpose. Live by design. Make a plan and choose what you're doing. And what I want to do here, when we finish this series, I want you to have a plan that you can get excited about. That's what I'm wanting you to do. That's why I want you to listen to this fill in the blank series about you, because I want us to come away with a plan that you can get excited about. Now, here's what I want you to do. Write down today's date, but put next year. Put this day and this month, but put next year. I'm going to tell you why. Because I want that in your calendar. So this time next year, you look at that date and you remember me telling you today that 1 year from today, your life is going to be better or worse than it is today. It's not going to be the same. You're going to be happier, sadder, richer or poorer, fatter or skinnier, married or divorced, but it is not going to be the same. Your life is going to be better or worse a year from now than it is right now. And a huge part of that is going to be a function of choices you make between now and then. And let me give you some bad news. Now that you've heard me say that, you're totally screwed. You cannot not choose, because not choosing is a choice. Think about it this way. Picture a crossroads out in the middle of the country, a big crossroads out in the middle of the country. Think about it. Two highways crossing each other in the middle of the country, and you come to that crossroads. What are your choices? You can go straight ahead. You can make a U-turn and go back. You can turn left, or you can turn right, or you can say, nope, not going to choose. Just going to stand right here in the middle of the intersection and just let life vroom, run right over me. Well, that's your fifth choice, but you cannot not choose. You are going to make choices, and I'm just saying own them. Since you're going to make a choice anyway, you might as well make a conscious choice. So I'm just saying, let's get active about some things. Let's get active about choosing. Don't just kind of choose by not choosing. Since you're going to make the choices anyway, do it on purpose. Live on purpose. Be on purpose.
Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. With Factors, restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. Pancakes, smoothies, and more. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day. The black pepper and sage pork chop is unbelievable. Juicy, tender, and full of flavor. So head to factormeals.com/fillintheblanks50 and use code fillintheblanks50 to get 50% off. That's code fillintheblanks50 at factormeals.com/fillintheblanks50 to get 50% off.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street, Essential Television.
Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist. She's a New York Times bestselling author. And in addition to her clinical practice, she's co-host of the popular Dear Therapist podcast, which is produced by my good friend Katie Couric. She also writes the Atlantic's weekly Dear Therapist advice column. We shoot in Hollywood, as you know, having been here. I ask people a lot, if you were going to write a script for the rest of your life, what would you want it to be? You know what you're living, you know what you're suffering, but if you were just king or queen in the forest and you could write the script for the rest of your life, what would it be? And it is very sad to see that they have a really difficult time envisioning being the star in their own life. Who's going to star in your life if it's not you? And they really have a hard time putting together a vision where they're the star in their own life.
Because nobody has ever asked them that. Nobody has ever said, you are the protagonist of your own life. How would you like this story to go? Most people have never thought about their own lives that way. They don't realize how much agency they actually have. And I think that's one of the most empowering things about asking yourself these questions. In my TED Talk, I get up on the stage and I say, we're all going to die. You know, that's something that I say to people. And I find that it really motivates people to know that life has 100% mortality rate. It's not for other people. Every single one of us is going to die. What do you want to do with your time here? And I think when people are really aware of that, not in a morbid way, but in a way that feels like I need to live with intentionality. When I wake up every day, am I living with intention? Am I living the kind of life that aligns with my values, that aligns with the kind of life I want to have? And if I'm not, what can I do differently? And what's keeping me from doing that?
I have this big ruler that's like 30 feet long and a foot wide that I roll out on stage sometimes, and it goes from 0 to 83, because that's kind of the life expectancy. I oftentimes will get somebody up to go stand on their age and say, okay, look over your shoulder, see how much is behind you. And if they're like 65 years old, they look over their shoulder and the 65 years behind them, now look ahead. And there's like this much ahead of them, like 2 feet ahead of them and 20 feet behind them. They're like, oh my God, you need to be who you are on purpose. You've got this much time left. How do you want to spend it? And it's astounding to me how that visual representation wakes people up sometimes when they go, oh my God. I mean, I've been a pilot since I was 16. I say one of the things that pilots have no use for is runway behind them. And you're standing here, you got all this runway behind you and this little bit ahead of you, and you don't know how much of that's going to be quality. You've got 20 years ahead of you, but is all of that going to be useful? Are you going to be healthy and vibrant all that time?
it really does wake people up sometimes. You've got to be who you are on purpose. I love that you talk to people about that and challenge them to write this up, figure out how they want to be in a new narrative and do what they want to do. And it's not about abandoning their lives. You don't have to leave everything. You just change the way you are. You're not going to drop your kids off at the mall and say, I want a new life, and just leave them there. But you can do it differently within the confines of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a woman that I write about in the book who is about to turn 70 and feels like that, you know, kind of the runway is behind her. And she doesn't know what she can change at this point. And she goes through extraordinary change. So I think it's never too late to change. And I feel like it's being really aware of how we're living our lives is important at any age. It's not just, you know, oh, let's look at the runway behind us. I think, we should be teaching that to our kids. Live with intention. Be clear about what you want, who you are, what is authentic to you, the kinds of relationships you want to have with others, the kind of relationship you want to have to yourself. That's important for all of us. And that's what I think you and I are both trying to do in our work.
Yeah. And I've hit 70. I guess that's really old when I was 30. It was even old when I was 50. And now it's like, it's just a number now because I'm starting some whole new things in my life. It's never too late. However much time you have, you want to make the most of it. I love the way you approach this. And I love the fact that you don't give people the answer. You lead them to discovery. You lead them to finding it by asking themselves the questions. Because let's face it, you and I might figure this out in the first hour. We can tell them it doesn't stick, but if they discover it, they'll never forget it. But they've got to discover it.
Well, absolutely. I also feel like people have the answers. They just don't necessarily have access to them. And our job is to help them access the answers that they already have.
We're seeing spikes in depression, anxiety, loneliness with our kids. We're seeing adults that are intimidated by what they used to take for granted in terms of social interaction and the competition of career. I think people thought when the quarantine was lifted, it was going to be like that scene from Grease when it was the last day of school and those doors flew open and they all ran out into the carnival and everybody was dancing and singing like, oh, it's over, we're free. And it hasn't been that way at all. A lot of people are feeling trepidation and resisting a little bit, having fear getting back into things that once was like falling off a log. What do you think people need to say to themselves as they transition back into a fully functioning world?
Well, I think that people have to realize that we've all been through a big change. And everybody has reacted differently and everybody's had different circumstances. And I think we need to allow for that. I think that, you know, we've talked about this collective trauma, but it's been different for different people. And so, and people are going to have different feelings about what it means to transition to something that feels more normal, but isn't quite normal because COVID is still here. So I think it's really important just to allow for people to have their experiences, not judge people for what they're experiencing, not fight with them about, you know, they need to feel a certain way because you feel a certain way. And just, I think if the pandemic taught us anything, it's about we need to have more compassion for one another.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Be patient. You'll get back to your stride. We'll find our way back. You haven't regressed to the point of no return. Just be patient with yourself. You'll get your legs back under you. We haven't passed the point of no return. I'm the incurable optimist, and I think that we will come back strong and we'll find our way back. So I agree. You say compassion and I add patience, and I think if we had those two things, we'll get back where we need to be quickly and recognize that we're being role models for our children. Sometimes they may roll their eyes and not seem to listen, but they are always watching. So if we're careful about what we model for them, we'll be doing them a big favor.
Yeah, I always say too that, you know, when I'm on stage and I'll say to people, who is the person that you talk to most in the course of your life? You know, I'll say show of hands, you know, is it your partner? Is it your child? Is it your best friend? Is it your sister? Whatever. I get lots of hands for those. But the person that we talk to most in the course of our lives is ourselves. And what we say to ourselves isn't always kind or true or useful. And so as we come out of this, I think we need to be especially aware of being kind to ourselves. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it useful? And if it's not, change the radio station. Find another way of talking to yourself. Because I think that the ways that we talk to ourselves and the voice in our head that is playing all the time has a huge impact on the quality of our lives in the day-to-day.
Dr. Phil here. Come February 27th, you're going to be able to pick up a book called We've Got Issues, and you know we do. This is a book that says it's going to teach you how to stand strong for America's soul and sanity. And in this book, I set forth 10 principles for saving this society from going off the deep end. 10 principles for protecting your family. 10 principles for giving you what you need to flourish and have the life that you want for yourself and for your children and for your grandchildren. We've taken some wrong turns. We've been letting the loudest voices dictate some of the thinking that has taken us way off course. Well, I'm speaking up and bringing us back to the center of the road. I hope you'll pick this book up, and I hope you'll read it with a real open mind, because I'm pushing back against a lot of what you've been hearing. Somebody had to do it. Might as well be me. February 27th, We've Got Issues.
I've got two dogs, Blue and Einstein. And your pet, just like mine, is one of a kind. And so is their journey. Sometimes our cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. And that's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/Phil. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/Phil. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/Phil. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
Pastor James Ward says that the core conviction to overcome is the first step to shifting from victim to zero victim thinking. So we're going to talk about Pastor James' book, Zero Victim, Overcoming Injustice with a New Attitude, and ways we can get out of victimhood. And when I say get out of victimhood, it really is an escape, because this can be a prison that we get caught in our lives. It can be a way of looking at things. It can be a lifestyle. It can be an attitude of approach to how we live our lives. I think Pastor James has really identified something that I think can be outcome determinative in a person's life. I didn't read you in the book as being a denier at all, being naive at all, seeing the world through rose-colored glasses at all, or asking your reader to do the same. In fact, I read you as saying, this is real, this happens, so you better get ready for it and check your mind. In fact, you say in the book that people with a victimhood mentality are undisciplined thinkers, I think is how you referred to it, as undisciplined thinkers. You're not checking your thinking. You're letting somebody else control your thinking. You're not being disciplined in your thinking.
Yeah. Undisciplined emotionally.
Right.
I talk about that as well, which I think is a conversation that's not happening. And I just want to be clear, we're not being condescending to people at all. But I think that people who are undisciplined emotionally are all over the nation right now. I think that this is the problem. I don't think that times are getting harder. I think people are getting weaker in some situations. I think that we're not conditioning and tempering our hearts and our minds to deal with the things that we're facing off with. Victim mentality right now, it's like being in a maximum security prison with no walls. And now all of a sudden we're creating safe spaces and all these kinds of things for people to retreat to because we're not building better people. We're not tempering our emotional thresholds, you know, in the workforce. I mean, well, check a resume. Where'd you go to school? How did you score on the LSAT, the GMAT, the GRE? But we're not checking emotionally. Are people tempered and strong from an emotional standpoint? And so I just think it's a quotient that's not being addressed. We're silent on the issue in society, and we're seeing victim thinking is now becoming the soil from which all of the division, all of the political vitriol, all of the hatred, all of the exasperated racism and the conflagration of emotions in our nation is all growing from the soil, the very fertile soil of victim thinking. And not just in the area of race. I deal with women who have been molested, who've gone through situations where they've been abused. We deal with folks who are dealing with divorce and going through bankruptcy. In any situation, victim thinking, it becomes like a maximum security prison with no walls. And my heart is to see people free, to see people liberated, to live in the dignity, to live out the fullness of God's call for their life. And it has everything to do with their perspective and how they manage the emotions. I say that emotions now have become, I use the term emotional, EWMDs, emotional weapons of mass destruction. And I think we're seeing that on a cataclysmic scale in our nation right now.
Well, I think you're right about what you're saying. One of the things that really jumped out at me that you said was, if we want to see a better nation, we must start by creating better, stronger people who do not see themselves as victims. And I worry right now when I see what's happening in schools, both K through 12 and in universities, that we are coddling, that we're not preparing students for the real world, because we're, like you said, it's like the prison without walls. We've got students now at some of the top universities in the country. An election result comes back that they don't like, and they're creating safe spaces for them to decompress. We have some universities that have brought in puppies for them to hold so they can not be so anxious. We have students that are getting tenured professors disciplined, suspended, and fired because they're offended by some of their ideology. I thought we went to the university to hear other people's point of view.
That's correct.
To steel ourselves against things we didn't believe or to be influenced by something we hadn't considered before. Now, I've seen studies anywhere from 15 to 30% of students think it's okay to yell down a speaker that disagrees with you. And students complaining if they're asked to take the other side of an argument on a final exam, the side they don't agree with, and argue that side to show that they've studied both sides of something. They go to the dean and complain, and the professor winds up getting disciplined or suspended or dismissed. We're not preparing strong people, because when you get out into the dog-eat-dog world where there's a lot of dogs after them bones, you better be tough and ready to go and not whining and being a victim where you say you've been damaged, you say you've been hurt.
Yeah. That's correct. And I think we're I mean, actually, it's ironic. You mentioned the university campus. We're being unintelligent in terms of how we deal with challenges and victimization in life. I mean, a simple premise, and I look at it three ways. There are the facts of victimization. There are the feelings of victimization, and there are the philosophies of victimization. So very, very briefly, the facts of victimization means that you analyze the situations and circumstances that you're dealing with intelligently. But then you also have to ask the question, if I'm being victimized, if I'm experiencing this, this victimization in my own life, was it some of me and was it some of my victimizer? Was it mostly them or a little bit of me or a little bit of me and some of them? When you talk about the facts of victimization, in most situations, when you analyze what actually transpired, it's not as bad as it's augmented. It's not as bad as how you feel it to be. So number one, we have to talk about the facts of victimization and be honest about those and be truthful. John 8:32, from a biblical standpoint, Jesus says, you should know the truth and the truth shall make you free. We got to start with the truth and the facts of victimization. Number two, there are feelings of victimization. Now you're talking about my emotional response, which is absolutely subjective, and that can go anywhere in any number of different directions. I think we're encouraging the feelings of victimization. We're not putting any premium on the facts of victimization. And then thirdly, that leads to philosophies of victimization that now is being taught, is being marketed, is being politicized, is being weaponized, and you're now seeing a growing movement that is being pushed in terms of the victim narrative. I think that many politicians have recognized that the greatest political capital in our nation right now is victim thinking. That if you can politicize and weaponize it and make a group of people believe that the other party made you a victim and my party is going to save you from victimhood, it creates a codependency that people will vote and you'll win landsliding elections all day. Now, I'm not speaking to any political group. I'm just telling you the power of politicizing, weaponizing victimization is happening in our society. The facts of victimization, the feelings of victimization, and the philosophies of victimization. And the university campus is exactly where we should be addressing these issues, as well as churches. I think that pastors like myself have a tremendous role to play in how we deal with this.
Well, I think you're exactly right about victimizing. I read an article today from the Wall Street Journal about an analyst saying that's how Trump got elected, that he came along and addressed a lot of white men who had lost a lot of opportunities over the last 20 or 30 years, that in 1965, there was one woman, I believe it was, in the Harvard Medical School graduating class. It was either one woman or one black. Fast forward like 40 years, and there were like 47, which means there were 47 less white men in that group. So he addressed all of these sort of things that nobody had been saying. And here are all of these guys that are supposedly the ones with a man's world privilege, white privilege, male privilege, who couldn't feel like they were able to whine or complain. And here comes somebody that's whining and complaining for them, and they all jumped on that bandwagon because they wanted to be victims but didn't feel like they could complain. And he gave them the opportunity to weaponize that victimization, and they jumped on the bandwagon. I'm talking to Pastor James Ward, and if you've just started paying attention or listening, he is the author of Zero Victim, Overcoming Injustice with a New Attitude. And the attitude is own your course through this life. Own your feelings, own your thinking, own your choices, that you don't have to step into the victim role. You can reject that. Let me say very clearly, he is not denying that there is systemic racism. He is not denying that there are people out there that will victimize you. He is not denying that there are circumstances or situations that will prey upon you and that you don't have a choice about that. What he's saying is you have a complete choice about what you do about it, what you say to yourself about it, whether you put it on and wear it like a coat or whether you throw it off and say, I'm going to choose how I react to this. Fair statement?
Very, very fair. Accurate. Zero victim thinking is preventative. It's preemptive. I use an analogy to describe how victim thinking works. And I use the analogy of baseball. And I like to say that the pitcher is a really, really bad guy because he throws this object that's rock hard at 100 miles an hour at this other guy behind home plate. That's not a nice thing to do. And let's just say that the catcher now on the receiving end of this projectile, this life-threatening projectile that's coming his way, if he is unprotected, unaware, and unprepared, he could easily lose his life with a baseball being thrown at him at 100 miles an hour. But because he prepares, because he preconditions his mind, he takes the proper stance, he puts on the right protective equipment, he stretches out his hand in anticipation of the pitch that's coming his way, and what was potentially a life-threatening situation has now become America's favorite pastime. It's a sport to him. Why? Because he manages the problem that is coming. That is how I describe the necessity of preconditioning your mind to develop a zero-victim mindset. The pitches are going to come. The victimization is going to come through relationships, through the work experience. This is something universal. The only qualification you need to be victimized is to be born. It happens to people all over. I talked to a number of folks who are immigrants from other countries who are saying, you don't understand victimization in America when you haven't had a tyrannical government and a dictator. And so there's just, it's part of life. The world's a hostile place. But again, the way that we prepare and precondition our minds to deal with those things determine whether or not they have effect on us at all. And that is my encouragement. You mentioned the power of attitude and why I acknowledge the internal discipline, the emotional discipline that's needed. I'll use another analogy. You know, I love college football. I love Alabama football. You know what? It makes me happy when my team wins. But if my team loses, I'm unhappy about it, but it doesn't rob me of my joy. My joy is separate and independent from whether or not my team wins or loses. So I'm happy if my team wins and I'm joyful, but if my team loses, I'm unhappy, but that doesn't mean I'm unjoyful. What's the difference? Happiness is a result based upon external circumstances, but joy is an internal, unchangeable reality. The same thing is true with freedom. The same thing is true with zero victim thinking. We got to build better people and equip people. I think this should be taught in the school systems. I think it should be taught in churches. That we've got to help folks be equipped to face off with the challenges that we're all facing, and really, really begin to kind of put this in the right framework.
When I say that these are toxic personalities, that doesn't mean they're evil human beings. It doesn't mean that they're second class citizens. It just means that their level of adjustment is such that they're toxic in your life. I'm not asking you to say, I'm putting myself in a position where I'm better than these people or I'm sitting in judgment of them. I'm just saying protect yourself. And let me give you an example. I think life is largely about intentions. I mean, doesn't it matter when somebody does something? Don't you want to know what their intention was? Think about this. If somebody's backing out of the driveway and you're standing there and they run over and crush your foot, if they did it on purpose, they saw you standing there, they were upset with you, they swerved the car over and crushed your foot on purpose, that's different than if they didn't see you and it was purely an accident. Does it matter that one had a bad intent and the other didn't have a bad intent at all? Yes, it does make a difference. However, your foot is just as crushed either way. right? Your foot is crushed just as bad either way. Now, I had a friend in my life when I was growing up, and this guy, I'm telling you, it was like he had a cloud over his head. It just seemed like drama followed him around. No matter what happened, no matter where we went, it just seemed like something bad always happened. Something got broken, a fight broke out, conflict. We could be at the Y swimming. Before you know it, he's involved in somebody hitting their head on the diving board. Did he push him? No. But was he involved? Yes. We would ride our motorcycles and there would be a crash. I mean, did he crash the other motorcycles? No. But was he involved in the crash? Yes. It was like he was always in the middle of catastrophe. Now, here's the thing. And my mother said this to me real clearly. She said, look, he's a good kid. There's no question about it. But I'm telling you, you hang around with him, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. It's not a matter of if you're going to get caught up and be in the crash, be in the drama, get in the fight. It's a matter of when it's going to happen, not if. Doesn't mean he's a bad person. It just seems to follow him around. Now, it would be indiscreet for me to say his name, JoJo, and she was right. He's been a friend forever, but somehow or another, JoJo just seems to attract this stuff. He could be sitting alone in a chair, and somehow or another, the leg would break, and a splinter would fly in somebody's eye, and a fight would break. Something would happen. I've asked you to do an audit, and I'm not asking you to sit in judgment. I'm just asking you to acknowledge, do you have these people in your life? And if you do, whether the intent is there or whether it's not, you have to make up your mind as to whether or not you're willing to put yourself at risk or whether you're not. Because I want you to have a winning strategy in your life. And that means you've got to make some hard decisions. Now, what did I say last time? I said that it begins with you having an image, deciding who you are. Deciding who you are and being consistent with that every step of the way. But you have to decide who you are, who you want to be. And part of that image needs to be that you have the right to have boundaries in your life. Now, you may decide that you're going to be assertive. You may decide that you're going to be more motivated. You're going to take greater initiative or whatever. And I said I wanted you to star in your own life. You remember that? I said, I want you to decide, look, this is no dress rehearsal. We don't get a second pass through this world. This is it. This is not a dress rehearsal, and they're going to come along and say, okay, you had that 50 years, now let's start over. We're going to get a second bite at the apple. No, you don't get a second bite at the apple. This is it. This is it. But I do believe in second chances. And you may not get to do the last 30 years over, the last 40 years over, but if you're 40 years old, you've lived over 10,000 days. And I'm just saying, let's do the next 10,000 with a different attitude. Decide who you want to be. Decide that you're going to star in your own life. And, you know, I said, you may think, okay, Dr. Phil, you got your own television show. You got your own massive podcast here. You've got this life in Hollywood. So it's easy to talk about being a star. That's not what I'm talking about. If you're a teacher, star in your own life as a teacher. If you're a plumber, star in your own life as a plumber. Be a star in your own life. I didn't say be a diva. I said be a star. Take pride in what you do. Take pride in what you do. I think it's really, really important that everything you do, you're someone that says, I do what I do with pride and commitment. That's very, very important in you having a strategy moving forward. Now, I told you that you need to learn to accept praise. Remember we talked about that? you don't want to dig your toe in the carpet and say, oh gosh, you know, it's no big deal. Well, it is a big deal. I want you to learn to own praise. When somebody says, hey, you did a great job, just say thank you. Accept it and own it. One of the things I want you to think about is what sets you apart from the rest of the world. If you want to rise above these toxic people in your life, if you want to not be defined by them, if you don't want to be dragged down by them, if you don't want to be codependent on these people, if you don't want to let them determine who you are, ask yourself, what is it about you that makes you essential in every relationship that you have, in every situation and circumstance that you have? You are not brand X. And you know how to become essential is know something other people don't know. Find out what it is that you uniquely add to a situation and cultivate that. What is it you do better than anybody else? What is it you do better than anybody else? There's an old joke that says, if you want to be a success, you need to do two things. Number one, never tell anybody everything you know. Number two, crickets. Because you don't tell anybody everything you know. Be essential. As a mother, you're essential. You do things nobody but you can do. If you work somewhere in an office, cultivate a skill that if you're gone, there is a missing element that they can't get by without. And maybe what you do is you become the best utility player there. You're the one that can fix that damn copier. You're the one that knows how to reset all the breakers in the building. You're the one guy that is willing to get up on the roof and get the air conditioners working. You're the one guy that knows the code on the computers that gets the accounting program working. Be that person that knows a lot of answers nobody else knows, and don't tell everybody everything you know. Be essential. And be unique in your knowledge. That makes you essential. Now, I'm talking about strategies here. I'm talking about strategies for getting ahead. Because what if, in this image that I'm talking about, you decide, I want better than what I have. I want more. And I don't care what your currency is. Everybody has a currency. And everybody's currency is a little bit different for them than it is the person next to them. Now, what's currency? Well, money. You know, monetary currency, that's real obvious, right? But even why people want money is different. Some people want money because of what they can buy with it. Some people want money because it represents that the world values them. It's how they keep score. It's not what they can buy with it. I mean, look at Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett lives in Omaha, Nebraska. He lives in a house that is very modest, very middle class. He's lived in it since he didn't have a lot of money, and now he's got billions and billions of dollars. He still lives in the same house. He still drives the same kind of cars. Money to him is not to acquire material things. Money to him obviously represents something else. It's a way of keeping score, and maybe it tells him he's winning. He's accumulating more than someone else. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But ask yourself, what is your currency? It's important that you understand, when you decide what your image is, ask yourself, what is unique about you? What do you know? What can you do? What is your skill set? What is your personality characteristic that is not common, that nobody else knows? And then when you apply it, when you get in the game and you use those essential skills, how do you keep score? What is your currency? That's the only way you're going to know if what you're doing is working or not. Maybe your currency is a closer walk with God. It's a spiritual experience. That's okay. It doesn't have to be about money. It could be your children being successful and happy and fulfilled. That's a great currency. Being closer to God, or whatever being you refer to as that being in your life, whether it's God or something else, that you feel closer to, that you feel fulfilled, whatever your currency is. Maybe you're to the point that you're not working for rent money anymore. Maybe that's not what's important to you now. Maybe you're past that. You know, Maslow says that we have a hierarchy of needs, and, you know, first is survival. And until we have that covered, we're not interested in much else. But when we have all of these different things covered, then we start thinking about actualization, where we start thinking about helping other people, giving to other people. Maybe you're at that point where you want to define your uniqueness in what you can do for other people. I'm just saying, I'm not trying to tell you what your currency is. I'm asking you to define what your currency is. And once you decide, okay, I know what my image is. I know who I am. And part of that image is the right to set up boundaries and get these toxic people out of my life. It doesn't matter whether they meant well or not. They're not working for me. It's not helping me in the pursuit of healthy goals. These people, maybe they'll work for somebody else. They don't work for me. Our chemistry isn't right. We don't click. Maybe they're just bad intent people, and you damn sure need to get rid of them. But you have the right to control your relationships and get people out of your life. That's part of your image. Control your relationships. Some people say, oh, I don't want to talk to this person, because when you say hello, it's going to be an hour. You know what? If that's true, you're not running your own life. Because you should be able to say, hey, it was good seeing you. Sorry, I can't visit right now. I got to go. And they go, oh, well, and get offended. Well, then let them get offended. If you need to go to pick up your kids, you don't need to hide in a broom closet when you see this person coming because they yammer on forever. Take control of your life. Don't hide. When you see them, say hi. They go, oh, I'm so glad to see you. I need to tell you something. Hold that thought. I don't have time to visit right now. I need to go pick up my kids, so I will see you later. Control your own relationships. Don't be a victim. That's part of this image I'm wanting you to own. Take control of your life. Part of your image is you have the right to set boundaries. You have the right to control your relationship. You have the right to get these toxic people out of your life. That's very, very important. That's part of your image. Part of your image is deciding what it is that's unique about you. Part of your image is deciding what your currency is. And then once you know those things and you say, okay, he wants me to star in my own life, what's my plan?